Amid the tickings and talkings of what sounded like at least 50,000 clocks, and totally undisturbed by them, Reginald Pop Merrill shone a pencil beam of light from a gadget even more slender than a doctor's ophthalmoscope into Kevin's Polaroid 660, while Kevin stood by. Pop's eyeglasses, which he didn't need for close work, were propped on the bald dome of his head. "Uh-huh," he said, and clicked the light off.
"Does that mean you know what's wrong with it?" Kevin asked.
"Nope," Pop Merrill said, and snapped the sun's film compartment, now empty, closed.
"Don't have a clue."
And before Kevin could say anything else, the clocks began to strike 4 o'clock. And for a few moments, conversation, although possible, seemed absurd. "I want to think it over," he had told his father on the evening he had turned 15, 3 days ago now. And it was a statement which had surprised both of them. As a child, he had made a career of not thinking about things, and Mr. Delavan had in his heart of hearts come to believe Kevin never would think about things, whether he ought to or not. They had been seduced, as fathers and sons often are, by the idea that their behavior and very different modes of thinking would never change, thus fixing their relationship eternally, and childhood would thus go on forever. "I want to think it over." There was a world of potential change implicit in that statement. Further, as a human being who had gone through his life to that point making most decisions on instinct rather than reason, and he was one of those lucky ones whose instincts were almost always good, the sort of person, in other words, who drives reasonable people mad, Kevin was surprised and intrigued to find that he was actually on the horns of a dilemma. Horn number one. He had wanted a Polaroid camera, and he had gotten one for his birthday. But, damn it, he had wanted a Polaroid camera that worked. Horn number two. He was deeply intrigued by Meg's use of the word supernatural. His younger sister had a daffy streak a mile wide, but she wasn't stupid, and Kevin didn't think she had used the word lightly or thoughtlessly. His father, who was of the reasonable rather than instinctive tribe, had scoffed, but Kevin found he wasn't ready to go and do likewise, at least not yet. That word, that fascinating, exotic word, it became a plinth which his mind couldn't help circling. "I think it's a manifestation." Kevin was amused and a little chagrined that only Meg had been smart enough or brave enough to actually say what should have occurred to all of them, given the oddity of the pictures the son produced. But in truth, it wasn't really that amazing. They were not a religious family. They went to church on the Christmas day every third year when Aunt Hilda came to spend the holiday with them instead of her other remaining relatives. But except for the occasional wedding or funeral, that was about all. If any of them truly believed in the invisible world, it was Megan, who couldn't get enough of walking corpses, living dolls, and cars that came to life and ran down people they didn't like. Neither of Kevin's parents had much taste for the bizarre. They didn't read their horoscopes in the daily paper. They would never mistake comets or falling stars for signs from the Almighty. Where one couple might see the face of Jesus on the bottom of an enchilada, John and Mary Delavan would see only an overcooked enchilada. It was not surprising that Kevin, who had never seen the man in the moon because neither mother nor father had bothered to point it out to him, had been likewise unable to see the possibility of a supernatural manifestation in a camera, which took the same picture over and over again, inside or outside, even in the dark of his bedroom closet, until it was suggested to him by his sister, who had once written a fan letter to Jason and gotten an autographed glossy photo of a guy in a blood-stained hockey mask by return mail. Once the possibility had been pointed out, it became difficult to unthink. As Dostoevsky, that smart old Russian, once said to his little brother when the two of them were both smart young Russians, "Try to spend the next 30 seconds not thinking of a blue-eyed polar bear." It was hard to do. So he had spent 2 days circling that plinth in his mind, trying to read hieroglyphics that weren't even there for pity's sake, and trying to decide which he wanted more, the camera or the possibility of a manifestation. Or, put another way, whether he wanted the sun or the man in the moon. By the end of the second day, even in 15-year-olds who are clearly destined for the reasonable tribe, dilemmas rarely last longer than a week. He had decided to take the man in the moon, on a trial basis at least. He came to this decision in study hall period 7, and when the bell rang, signaling the end of both the study hall and the school day, he had gone to the teacher he respected most, Mr. Baker, and had asked him if he knew of anyone who repaired cameras. "Not like a regular camera shop guy," he explained. "More like a, you know, a thoughtful guy." "An F-stop philosopher?" Mr. Baker asked. His saying things like that was one of the reasons why Kevin respected him. It was just a cool thing to say. "A sage of the shutter. An alchemist of the aperture. A guy who's seen a lot," Kevin said cagily. "Pop Merrill," Mr. Baker said. "Who?" "He runs the Emporium Galorium." "Oh, that place." "Yeah," Mr. Baker said, grinning. "That place. If that is what you're looking for, is a sort of homespun Mr. Fix-It." "I guess that's what I'm looking for." "He's got damn near everything in there," Mr. Baker said, and Kevin could agree with that. Even though he had never actually been inside, he passed the Emporium Galorium 5, 10, maybe 15 times a week. In a town the size of Castle Rock, you had to pass everything a lot, and it got amazingly boring, in Kevin Delavan's humble opinion. And he had looked in the windows. It seemed crammed literally to the rafters with objects, most of them mechanical. But his mother called it a junk store, in a sniffing voice, and his father said Mr. Merrill made his money rooking the summer people. And so Kevin had never gone in. If it had only been a junk store, he might have, almost certainly would have, in fact. But doing what the summer people did, or buying something where summer people got rooked, was unthinkable. He would be as apt to wear a blouse and skirt to high school. Summer people could do what they wanted, and did. They were all mad, and conducted their affairs in a mad fashion. Exist with them? Fine. But be confused with them? No, no, and no, sir. "Damn near everything," Mr. Baker repeated. "Most of what he's got, he fixed himself. He thinks that Cracker Barrel philosopher act he does, glasses up on top of the head, wise pronouncements, all of that, fools people. No one who knows him disabuses him. I'm not sure anyone would dare disabuse him." "Why? What do you mean?" Mr. Baker shrugged. An odd, tight little smile touched his mouth. "Top, Mr. Merrill, I mean, has got his fingers in a lot of pies around here. You'd be surprised, Kevin." Kevin didn't care about how many pies Pop Merrill was currently fingering, or what their fillings might be. He was left with only one more important question. Since the summer people were gone, he could probably slink into the Emporium Galorium unseen tomorrow afternoon, if he took advantage of the rule which allowed all students but freshmen to cut their last period study hall twice a month. "Do I call him Pop or Mr. Merrill?" Solemnly, Mr. Baker replied, "I think the man kills anyone under the age of 60 who calls him Pop." And the thing was, Kevin had an idea Mr. Baker wasn't exactly joking. "You really don't know, huh?" Kevin said when the clocks began to wind down. It had not been like in a movie, where they all start and finish striking at once. These were real clocks, and he guessed that most of them, along with the rest of the appliances in the Emporium Galorium, were not really running at all, but sort of lurching along. They had begun at what his own Seiko quartz watch said was 3:58. They began to pick up speed and volume gradually, like an old truck fetching second gear with a tired groan and jerk. There were maybe 4 seconds when all of them really did seem to be striking, bonging, chiming, clanging, and cuckooing at the same time. But 4 seconds was all the synchronicity they could manage. And winding down was not exactly what they did. What they did was sort of give up, like water finally consenting to gurgle its way down a drain, which is almost but not quite completely plugged. He didn't have any idea why he was so disappointed. Had he really expected anything else? For Pop Merrill, whom Mr. Baker had described as a Cracker Barrel philosopher and homespun Mr. Fixit, to pull out a spring and say, "Here it is! This is the bastard causing that dog to show up every time you push the shutter release. It's a dog spring. Belongs in one of those toy dogs. A kid winds up so it'll hawk in back a little. Some joker on the Polaroid Sun 660 assembly line's always putting them in the damn cameras." Had he expected that? No. But he had expected something.
"Don't have a friggin' clue,"
Pop repeated cheerfully. He reached behind him and took a Douglas MacArthur corncob pipe from a holder shaped like a bucket seat. He began to tamp tobacco into it from an imitation leather pouch with the words, "Evil Weed," stamped into it.
"Can't even take these babies apart, you know."
"You can't?"
"Nope,"
Pop said. He was just as chipper as a bird. He paused long enough to hook a thumb over the wire ridge between the lenses of his rimless specs and give them a yank. They dropped off his bald dome and fell neatly into place, hiding the red spots on the side of his nose with a fleshy little thump.
"You could take apart the old ones,"
he went on, now producing a diamond blue-tip match from a pocket of his vest. Of course he was wearing a vest. And pressing the thick yellow thumbnail of his right hand on its head. Yes, this was a man who could rook the summer people with one hand tied behind his back, always assuming it wasn't the one he used to first fish out his matches and then light them. Even at 15 years of age, Kevin could see that. Pop Merrill had style.
"The Polaroid land cameras, I mean. Ever see one of those beauties?"
"No," Kevin said. Pop snapped the match alight on the first try, which, of course, he would always do, and applied it to the corncob, his words sending out little smoke signals, which looked pretty and smelled absolutely foul.
"Oh, yeah," he said. "They look like those old-time cameras people like Matthew Brady used before the turn of the century, or before the Kodak people introduced the Brownie box camera, anyway. What I mean to say is..."
Kevin was rapidly learning that this was Pop Merrill's favorite phrase. He used it the way some of the kids in school used, you know, as intensifier, modifier, qualifier, and most of all as a convenient thought-gathering pause.
"They tricked it up some, put on chrome and real leather side panels, but it still looked old-fashioned, like the sort of camera folks used to make daguerreotypes with. When you opened up one of those old Polaroid land cameras, it snapped out an accordion neck, because the lens needed half a foot, maybe even 9 inches, to focus the image. It looked old-fashioned as hell when you put it next to one of the Kodaks in the late 40s and early 50s, and it was like those old daguerreotype cameras in another way. It only took black-and-white photos."
"Is that so?" Kevin asked, interested in spite of himself.
"Oh, yeah,"
Pop said, chipper as a chickadee, blue eyes twinkling at Kevin through the smoke from his fuming stewpot of a pipe and from behind his round, rimless glasses. It was the sort of twinkle which may indicate either good humor or avarice.
"What I mean to say is that people laughed at those cameras the way they laughed at the Volkswagen Beetles when they first came out. But they bought the Polaroids just like they bought the VWs, because the Beetles got good gas mileage and didn't go bust so often as American cars. And the Polaroids did one thing the Kodaks and even the Nikons and Minoltas and Leicas didn't."
"Took instant pictures?" Pop smiled.
"Well, not exactly. What I mean to say is, you took your picture, then you yanked on this flap to pull it out. It didn't have no motor. Didn't make that squidgy little whining noise like modern Polaroids."
So there was a perfect way to describe that sound after all. It was just that you had to find a Pop Merrill to tell it to you. The sound that Polaroid cameras made when they spat out their product was a squidgy little whine.
"Then you had to timer,"
Pop said. Time?
Oh, Anne,
Pop said with great relish, bright as the early bird who has found that fabled worm.
What I mean to say is, they didn't have none of this happy automatic crappy back in those days. You yank, and out come this long strip, which you put on the table or whatever, and timed off 60 seconds on your watch. Had to be 60, or right around there anyway. Less, and you'd have an underexposed picture. More, and it'd be overexposed.
Wow,
Kevin said respectfully. And this was not bogus respect, jollying the old man along in hopes he would get back to the point, which was not a bunch of long-dead cameras that had been wonders in their day, but his own camera, the damned balky Sun 660, sitting on Pop's work table with the guts of an old seven-day clock on its right and something which looked suspiciously like a dildo on its left. It wasn't bogus respect, and Pop knew it, and it occurred to Pop, it wouldn't have to Kevin, how fleeting that great white god, state-of-the-art, really was. 10 years, he thought, and the phrase itself would be gone. From the boy's fascinated expression, you would have thought he was hearing about something as antique as George Washington's wooden dentures, instead of a camera everyone had thought was the ultimate only 35 years ago. But of course, this boy had still been circling around in the unhatched void 35 years ago, part of a female who hadn't yet even met the male who would provide his other half.
What I mean to say is, it was a regular little back room going on in there between the picture and the backing.
Pop resumed, slow at first, but speeding up as his own mostly genuine interest in the subject resurfaced. But the thoughts of who this kid's father was, and what the kid might be worth to him, and the strange thing the kid's camera was up to never completely left his mind.
And at the end of the minute, you peeled the picture off the back. Had to be careful when you did it, too, because there was all this goo-like jelly on the back, and if your skin was in the least bit sensitive, you could get a pretty good burn.
Awesome,
Kevin said. His eyes were wide, and now he looked like a kid hearing about the old two-holer outhouses, which Pop and all his childhood colleagues, they were almost all colleagues, he had had few childhood friends in Castle Rock, perhaps preparing even then for his life's work of rooking the summer people, and the other children somehow sensing it, like a faint smell of skunk, had taken for granted, doing your business as fast as you could in high summer, because one of the wasps, always circling around down there between the manna and the two holes which were the heaven from which the manna fell, might at any time take a notion to plant its stinger in one of your tender little boy cheeks, and also doing it as fast as you could in deep winter, because your tender little boy cheeks were apt to freeze solid if you didn't.
Well, Pop thought, so much for the camera of the future. 35 years, and to this kid it's interesting in the same way a backyard shithouse is interesting. The negative was on the back, Pop said, and your positive, well, it was black and white, but it was fine black and white. It was just as crisp and clear as you'd ever want, even today. And you had this little pink thing, out as long as the school eraser, as I remember. It squeegeed out some kind of chemical, smelled like ether, and you had to rub it over the picture as fast as you could, or that picture would roll right up, like the tube in the middle of a roll of bung fodder.
Kevin burst out laughing, tickled by these pleasant antiquities. Pop quit long enough to get his pipe going again. When he had, he resumed.
A camera like that, nobody but the Polaroid people really knew what it was doing. I mean to say, those people were close, but it was mechanical. You could take it apart.
He looked at Kevin's son with some distaste.
And lots of times, when one went bust, that was as much as you needed. Fella'd come in with one of those and say it wouldn't work, moaning about how he'd have to send it back to the Polaroid people to get it fixed, and that'd probably take months, and would I take a look? Well, I'd say, probably nothing I can do. What I mean to say is nobody really knows about these cameras but the Polaroid people and the goddamn close. But I'll take a look. All the time knowing it was probably just a loose screw inside that shutter housing, or maybe a fouled spring, or hell, maybe Junior slathered some peanut butter in the film compartment.
One of his bright bird eyes dropped in a wink so quick, and so marvelously sly, that Kevin thought, If you hadn't known he was talking about summer people, you would have thought it was your paranoid imagination, or, more likely, missed it entirely.
What I mean to say is you have your perfect situation,
Pop said.
If you could fix it, you were a goddamn wonder worker. Why, I put $8.50 in my pocket for taking a couple of little pieces of potato chip out from between the trigger and the shutter spring, my son, and the woman who brought that camera in kissed me on the lips, right on the lips.
Kevin observed Pop's eye drop momentarily closed again behind the semi-transparent mat of blue smoke.
And of course, if it was something you couldn't fix, they didn't hold it against you because, what I mean to say, they never really expected you to be able to do nothing in the first place. You was only a last resort before they put her in a box and stuffed newspaper around her to keep her from being broke even worse in the mail and shipped her off to Schenectady. But this camera...
He spoke in the ritualistic tone of distaste all philosophers of the Cracker Barrel, whether in Athens of the Golden Age or in a small town junk shop during this current one of brass, adopt to express their view of entropy without having to come right out and state it.
Wasn't put together, son. What I mean to say is it was poured. I could maybe pop the lens and will if you want me to, and I did look in the film compartment, although I knew I wouldn't see a goddamn thing wrong, that I recognized at least, and I didn't. But beyond that, I can't go. I could take a hammer and wind it right to her, could break it, what I mean to say, but fix it?
He spread his hands in pipe smoke.
No, sir.
Then I guess I'll just have to return it after all, he meant to finish, but Pop broke in.
Anyway, son, I think you knew that. What I mean to say is, you're a bright boy. You can see when a thing's all of a piece. I don't think you brought that camera in to be fixed. I think you know that even if it wasn't all of a piece, a man couldn't fix what that thing's doing. At least not with a screwdriver. I think you brought it in to ask me if I knew what it's up to.
Do you? Kevin asked. He was suddenly tense all over.
I might,
Pop Merrill said calmly. He bent over the pile of photographs, 28 of them now, counting the one Kevin had snapped to demonstrate and the one Pop had snapped to demonstrate to himself.
These in order?
Not really. Pretty close, though. Does it matter?
I think so, Pop said. They're a little bit different, ain't they? Not much, but a little.
Yeah, Kevin said. I can see the difference in some of them, but...
Do you know which one is the first? I could probably figure it out for myself, but time is money, son.
That's easy, Kevin said, and picked one out of the untidy little pile. See the frosting? He pointed at a small brown spot on the picture's white edging.
Well...
Pop didn't spare the dab of frosting more than a glance. He looked closely at the photograph, and after a moment, he opened the drawer of his work table. Tools were littered untidily about inside. To one side, in its own space, was an object wrapped in jeweler's velvet. Pop took this out, folded the cloth back, and removed a large magnifying glass with a switch in its base. He bent over the Polaroid and pushed the switch. Bright circle of light fell on the picture's surface.
That's neat, Kevin said.
Hey up,
Pop said again. Kevin could tell that for Pop he was no longer there. Pop was studying the picture closely. If one had not known the odd circumstances of its taking, the picture would hardly have seemed to warrant such close scrutiny. Like most photographs which are taken with a decent camera, good film, and by a photographer at least intelligent enough to keep his finger from blocking the lens, it was clear, understandable, and like so many Polaroids, oddly undramatic. It was a picture in which you could identify and name each object, but its content was as flat as its surface. It was not well composed, but composition wasn't what was wrong with it. That undramatic flatness could hardly be called wrong at all, any more than a real day in a real life could be called wrong because nothing worthy of even a made-for-television movie happened during its course. As in so many Polaroids, the things in the picture were only there, like an empty chair on a porch, or an unoccupied child's swing in a backyard, or a passengerless car sitting at an unremarkable curb without even a flat tire to make it interesting or unique. What was wrong with the picture was the feeling that it was wrong. Kevin had remembered the sense of unease he had felt while composing his subjects for the picture he meant to take, and the ripple of goose flesh up his back when, with the glare of the flash bulb still lighting the room, he had thought, "It's mine." That was what was wrong. And as with the man in the moon, you can't unsee once you've seen it, so he was discovering you couldn't unfeel certain feelings. And when it came to these pictures, those feelings were bad. Kevin thought, "It's like there was a wind, very soft, very cold, blowing out of that picture." For the first time, the idea that it might be something supernatural, that this was part of a manifestation, did something more than just intrigue him. For the first time, he found himself wishing he had simply let this thing go. "It's mine." That was what he had thought when his finger had pushed the shutter button for the first time. Now he found himself wondering if maybe he hadn't gotten that backward. "I'm scared of it, of what it's doing." That made him mad, and he bent over Pop Merrill's shoulder, hunting as grimly as a man who has lost a diamond in a sand pile. Determined that no matter what he saw, always supposing he should see something new, and he didn't think he would, he'd studied all these photographs often enough now to believe he had seen all there was to see in them, he would look at it, study it, and under no circumstances allow himself to unsee it, even if he could. And a dolorous voice inside suggested very strongly that the time for unseeing was now past, possibly forever. What the picture showed was a large black dog in front of a white picket fence. The picket fence wasn't going to be white much longer, unless someone in that flat Polaroid world painted or at least whitewashed it. That didn't seem likely. The fence looked untended, forgotten. The tops of some pickets were broken off, others sagged loosely outward. The dog was on a sidewalk in front of the fence. His hind quarters were to the viewer. His tail, long and bushy, drooped. He appeared to be smelling one of the fence pickets. Probably, Kevin thought, because the fence was what his dad called a letter drop, a place where many dogs would lift their legs and leave mystic yellow squirts of message before moving on. The dog looked like a stray to Kevin. Its coat was long and tangled and sewn with burdocks. One of its ears had the crumpled look of an old battle scar. Its shadow trailed long enough to finish outside the frame on the weedy, patchy lawn inside the picket fence. The shadow made Kevin think the picture had been taken not long after dawn, or not long before sunset, with no idea of the direction the photographer, what photographer, ha ha, had been facing. It was impossible to tell which, just that he, or she, must have been standing only a few degrees shy of due east or west. There was something in the grass at the far left of the picture which looked like a child's red rubber ball. It was inside the fence, and enough behind one of the lackluster clumps of grass, so it was hard to tell. And that was all.
"Do you recognize anything?"
Pop asked, cruising his magnifying glass slowly back and forth over the photo's surface. Now the dog's hindquarters swelled to the size of hillocks, tangled with wild and ominously exotic black undergrowth. Now three or four of the scaly pickets became the size of old telephone poles. Now, suddenly, the object behind the clump of grass clearly became a child's ball, although under Pop's glass it was as big as a soccer ball. Kevin could even see the stars, which girdled its middle in upraised rubber lines. So something new was revealed under Pop's glass, and in a few moments Kevin would see something else himself, without it. But that was later.
"Geez, no," Kevin said. "How could I, Mr. Merrill?"
"Because there are things here,"
Pop said patiently. His glass went on cruising. Kevin thought of a movie he had seen once where the cops sent out a searchlight-equipped helicopter to look for escaped prisoners.
"A dog, a sidewalk, a picket fence that needs painting or taking down, a lawn that needs tending. The sidewalk ain't much. You can't even see all of it, and the house, even the foundation, ain't in the frame. But what I mean to say is, there's that dog. You recognize it?
No.
The fence?
No.
What about that red rubber ball? What about that, son?
No, but you look like you think I should.
I look like I thought you might,
Pop said.
You never had a ball like that when you were a tyke?
Not that I remember, no.
You got a sister, you said.
Megan.
She never had a ball like that?
I don't think so. I never took that much interest in Meg's toys. She had a bolo bouncer once, and the ball on the end of it was red, but a different shade, darker.
Well, I know what a ball like that looks like. This ain't one. And that mightn't be your lawn?
Jeez, I mean, jeepers, no.
Kevin felt a little offended. He and his dad took good care of the lawn around their house. It was a deep green and would stay that way, even under the fallen leaves, until at least mid-October. We don't have a picket fence anyway. And if we did, he thought, it wouldn't look like that mess. Pop let go of the switch in the base of the magnifying glass, placed it on the square of jeweler's velvet, and with a care which approached reverence, folded the sides over it. He returned it to its former place in the drawer and closed the drawer. He looked at Kevin closely. He had put his pipe aside, and there was now no smoke to obscure his eyes, which were still sharp, but not twinkling any more.
What I mean to say is, could it have been your house before you owned it? Do you think 10 years ago?
We owned it 10 years ago, Kevin replied, bewildered.
Well, 20, 30. What I mean to say, do you recognize how the land lies? Looks like it climbs a little.
Our front lawn, he thought deeply, then shook his head. No, ours is flat. If it does anything, it goes down a little. Maybe that's why the cellar ships a little water in a wet spring.
There, could be. What about the back lawn?
There's no sidewalk back there, Kevin said. And on both sides, he broke off. You're trying to find out if my camera's taking pictures of the past, he said. And for the first time, he was really, actively frightened. He rubbed his tongue on the roof of his mouth and seemed to taste metal.
I was just asking.
Pop wrapped his fingers beside the photographs, and when he spoke, it seemed to be more to himself than to Kevin.
You know, he said, some goddamn funny things seem to happen from time to time with two gadgets we've come to take pretty much for granted. I ain't saying they do happen, only if they don't, there are a lot of liars and out-and-out hoaxes in the world.
What gadgets?
Tape recorders and Polaroid cameras,
Pop said, still seeming to talk to the pictures or himself, and there was no Kevin in this dusty, clock-drumming space at the back of the Emporium Galorium at all.
Take tape recorders. Do you know how many people claim to have recorded the voices of dead folks on tape recorders?
No,
Kevin said. He didn't particularly mean for his own voice to come out hushed, but it did. He didn't seem to have a whole lot of air in his lungs to speak with, for some reason or other.
Me neither,
Pop said, stirring the photographs with one finger. It was blunt and gnarled, a finger which looked made for rude and clumsy motions and operations, for poking people and knocking vases off end tables, and causing nosebleeds if it tried to do so much as hook a humble chunk of dried snot from one of its owner's nostrils. Yet Kevin had watched the man's hands and thought there was probably more grace in that one finger than his sister Meg's entire body, and maybe in his own. Clan Delavan was not known for its light-footedness or handedness, which was probably one reason why he thought that image of his father so nimbly catching his mother on the way down had stuck with him and might forever. Pop Merrill's finger looked as if it would, at any moment, sweep all the photographs onto the floor. By mistake, this sort of clumsy finger would always poke and knock and tweak by mistake, but it did not. The Polaroid seemed to barely stir in response to its restless movements.
Supernatural, Kevin thought again, and shivered a little. An actual shiver. Surprising and dismaying, and a little embarrassing, even if Pop had not seen it.
But there's even a way they do it,
Pop said, and then, as if Kevin had asked,
who? Damn if I know. I guess some of them are psychic investigators, or at least call themselves that or some such. But I guess it's more than likely most of them are just playing around like folks that use Ouija boards at parties.
He looked up at Kevin grimly, as if rediscovering him.
You got a Ouija board, son?
No.
Ever played with one?
No.
Don't,
Pop said more grimly than ever.
Fucking things are dangerous.
Kevin didn't dare tell the old man he hadn't the slightest idea what a Ouija board was.
Anyhow, they set up the tape machine to record in an empty room. It's supposed to be an old house, is what I mean to say. One with a history, if they can find it. Do you know what I mean when I say a house with a history, son?
I guess like a haunted house, Kevin hazarded. He found he was sweating lightly, as he had done last year every time Mrs. Whittaker announced a pop quiz in Algebra 1.
Well, that'll do. These people like it best if it's a house with a violent history, but they'll take what they can get. Anyhow, they set up the machine and record that empty room. Then the next day, they always do it at night, is what I mean to say. They ain't happy unless they can do it at night, and midnight if they can get it. The next day, they play her back.
An empty room?
Sometimes,
Pop said in a musing voice that might or might not have disguised some deeper feeling.
There are voices.
Kevin shivered again. There were hieroglyphics on the plinth, after all. Nothing you'd want to read, but, yeah, they were there.
Real voices?
Usually imagination,
Pop said dismissively.
But once or twice, I've heard people I trust say they've heard real voices.
But you never have.
Once,
Pop said shortly, and said nothing else for so long, Kevin was beginning to think he was done, when he added,
it was one word, clear as a bell. It was recorded in the parlor of an empty house in Bath. Man killed his wife there in 1946.
What was the word?
Kevin asked, knowing he would not be told, just as surely as he knew no power on earth, certainly not his own willpower, could have kept him from asking.
But Pop did tell.
Basin.
Kevin blinked.
Basin?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything.
It might,
Pop said calmly.
If you know he cut her throat, then held her head over a basin to catch the blood.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, really?
Pop didn't bother answering that.
It couldn't have been a fake?
Pop gestured with the stem of his pipe at the Polaroids.
Are those?
Oh, my God.
Polaroids now,
Pop said, like a narrator moving briskly to a new chapter in a novel and reading the words, meanwhile, in another part of the forest.
I've seen pictures with people in them that the other people in the picture swear weren't there with them when the picture was taken. And there's one, this is a famous one, that a lady took over in England. What she did was snap a picture of some fox hunters coming back home at the end of the day. You see them, about 20 and all, coming over a little wooden bridge. It's a tree-lined country road on both sides of that bridge. The ones in front are off the bridge already, and over on the right of the picture, standing by the road, there's a lady in a long dress, in a hat, with a veil on it so you can't see her face, and she's got a pocketbook over her arm. Why, you can't even see she's wearing a locket on her bosom, or maybe it's a watch. Well, when the lady that took the picture saw it, she got wicked upset, and wasn't nobody could blame her, son, because what I mean to say is, she meant to take a picture of those fox hunters coming home and no one else, because there wasn't nobody else there, except in the picture there is. And when you look real close, it seems like you can see the trees right through that lady.
He's making all this up, putting me on, and when I leave, he'll have a great big horse laugh,
Kevin thought, knowing Pop Merrill was doing nothing of the sort.
The lady that took that picture was staying at one of those big English homes like they have on the educational TV shows, and when she showed that picture, I heard the man of the house fainted dead away. That part could be made up, probably is. Sounds made up, don't it? But I seen that picture in an article next to a painted portrait of that fellow's great-grandmother, and it could be her, all right. Can't tell for certain because of the veil, but it could be.
Could be a hoax, too,
Kevin said faintly.
Could be,
Pop said indifferently.
People get up to all sorts of didos. Look at my nephew there, for instance, Ace.
Pop's nose wrinkled.
Doing 4 years in Shawshank, and for what? Busting into the Mellow Tiger. He got up to didos, and Sheriff Pangborn slammed him in the jug for it. Little ringmeat got just what he deserved.
Kevin, displaying a wisdom far beyond his years, said nothing.
But when ghosts show up in photographs, son, or like you say, what people claim to be ghosts, it's almost always in Polaroid photographs, and it almost always seems to be by accident. Now, your pictures of flying saucers and that Loch Ness monster, they almost always show up in the other kind, the kind some smart fella can get up to didos with in the dark room.
He dropped Kevin a third wink, expressing all the didos, whatever they were, an unscrupulous photographer might get up to in a well-equipped darkroom. Kevin thought of asking Pop if it were possible someone could get up to didos with a Ouija and decided to continue keeping his mouth shut. It still seemed by far the wisest course.
All by way of saying, I thought I'd ask if you saw something you knew in these Polaroid pictures.
I don't, though, Kevin said, so earnestly that he believed Pop would believe he was lying, as his mom always did when he made the tactical mistake of even controlled vehemence.
Hey,
Pop said, believing him so dismissively Kevin was almost irritated.
Well,
Kevin said after a moment, which was silent except for the 50,000 ticking clocks. I guess that's it, huh?
Maybe not,
Pop said.
What I mean to say is, I got me a little idea. You mind taking some more pictures with that camera?
What good is it? They're all the same.
That's the point. They ain't.
Kevin opened his mouth, then closed it.
I'll even chip in for the film,
Pop said. And when he saw the amazed look on Kevin's face, he quickly qualified.
A little, anyway.
How many pictures would you want?
Well, you got, what, 28 already. Is that right?
Yes, I think so.
30 more,
Pop said after a moment's thought.
Why?
Ain't gonna tell you. Not right now.
He produced a heavy purse that was hooked to a belt loop on a steel chain. He opened it and took out a $10 bill, hesitated, and added two ones with obvious reluctance.
Guess that'd cover half of it.
Yeah, right, Kevin thought.
If you really are interested in the trick that camera's doing, I guess you'd pony up the rest, wouldn't you?
Pop's eyes gleamed at him like the eyes of an old, curious cat. Kevin understood the man did more than expect him to say yes. To Pop, it was inconceivable that he could say no. Kevin thought, if I said no, he wouldn't hear it. He'd say, good, that's agreed then. And I'd end up back on the sidewalk with his money in my pocket, whether I wanted it or not. And he did have his birthday money. All the same, there was that chill wind to think about. That wind that seemed to blow, not from the surface, but right out of those photographs, in spite of their deceptively flat, deceptively shiny surfaces. He felt that wind coming from them despite their mute declaration, which averred, we are Polaroids, and for no reason we can tell or even understand, we show only the undramatic surface of things. That wind was there. What about that wind? Kevin hesitated a moment longer, and the bright eyes behind the rimless spectacles measured him.
I ain't gonna ask you if you're a man or a mouse, Pop Merrill's eyes said. You're 15 years old. What I mean to say is at 15 you may not be a man yet, not quite, but you are too goddamn old to be a mouse, and both of us know it. And besides, you're not from away, you're from town, just like me.
Sure, Kevin said with a hollow lightness in his voice. It fooled neither of them. I can get the film tonight, I guess, and bring the pictures in tomorrow after school.
Nope,
Pop said. You're closed tomorrow?
Nope,
Pop said. And because he was from town, Kevin waited patiently.
You're thinking about taking 30 pictures all at once, aren't you?
I guess so.
That ain't the way I want you to do it,
Pop said.
It don't matter where you take them, but it does matter when. Here, let me figure.
Pop figured, and then even wrote down a list of times which Kevin pocketed.
So,
Pop said, rubbing his hands briskly together so that they made a dry sound that was like two pieces of used-up sandpaper rubbing together.
You'll see me in, oh, 3 days or so?
Yes, I guess so.
I'll bet you just as lief wait until Monday after school anyway,
Pop said. He got Kevin a fourth wink, slow and sly and humiliating in the extreme.
So your friends don't see you coming in here and catch you with it, is what I mean to say.
Kevin flushed and dropped his eyes to the work table and began to gather up the Polaroids so his hands would have something to do. When he was embarrassed, and they didn't, he cracked his knuckles. He began some sort of absurd protest that would convince neither of them, and then stopped, staring down at one of the photos.
What?
Pop asked. For the first time since Kevin had approached him, Pop sounded entirely human, but Kevin hardly heard his words, much less his tone of faint alarm.
Now you look like you've seen a ghost, boy.
No, Kevin said. No ghost. I see who took the picture. Who really took the picture?
What in glory are you talking about?
Kevin pointed to a shadow. He, his father, his mother, Meg, and apparently Mr. Merrill himself had taken it for the shadow of a tree that wasn't itself in the frame. But it wasn't a tree. Kevin saw that now. And what you had seen could never be unseen. More hieroglyphics on the plinth.
I don't see what you're getting at,
Pop said. But Kevin knew the old man knew he was getting at something, which was why he sounded put out. Look at the shadow of the dog first, Kevin said. Then look at this one here again. He tapped the left side of the photograph. In the picture, the sun is either going down or coming up. That makes all the shadows long, and it's hard to tell what's throwing them, but looking at it just now, it clicked home for me.
What clicked home, son?
Pop reached into the drawer, probably meaning to get the magnifying glass with the light in it again, and then stopped. All at once, he didn't need it. All at once, it had clicked into place for him, too.
It's the shadow of a man, ain't it?
Pop said.
I'll be go to hell if that one ain't the shadow of a man.
Or a woman. You can't tell. Those are legs, I'm sure they are, but they could belong to a woman wearing pants. Or even a kid, with the shadow running so long.
There, you can't tell.
Kevin said,
it's the shadow of whoever took it, isn't it? There.
But it wasn't me, Kevin said. It came out of my camera, all of them did. But I didn't take it.
So who did, Mr. Merrill? Who did?
Call me Pop,
the old man said absently, looking at the shadow in the picture. And Kevin felt his chest swell with pleasure, as those few clocks still capable of running a little fast began to signal the others that, weary as they might be, it was time to charge the half hour.